Hello, everyone. This is the first in a series of podcasts where we're going to cover a range of topics that would allow the members to think about emerging risks and topics from a different lens, to think about non-traditional areas in insurance. In these thought leadership podcasts, we plan to interview scientists, researchers, engineers, professionals from different walks of life to talk about risks that are relevant to insurance and could possibly offer a different perspective. For newer members of the profession listening to actuaries talk about their experience would provide valuable guidance in developing their career and should also provide considerable motivation. And you might get CPD credits for some of the episodes, but you probably need to listen all the way through to find out. I'm Adiraj Maitra, the current chair of GI Research and Thought Leadership Subcommittee. I've got Zvi Ebert, a fellow member of the committee, and Samir Kashani, who's the chair of GI Board. Together, we will be interviewing Tan Sui Chi, the current president of the IFOA, in today's episode. Sui Chi is currently independent non-exec director at several organizations. He has held the group CEO role at NTUC from 2013 to 2017, and he has also been the CEO there, NTUC Income, from 2006 to 2013. Sui Chi has a degree from UCL in economics and a master's in organizational psychology. Hello, Sui Chi. Thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Adiraj. Very good to see you and Samir and Iri. And a minor correction, just for I actually graduated from LSE, not UCL, in actuarial science, and that's fine. Yeah, that's fine.
My computer, I had it open and then it kind of locked its screen and I couldn't, but I'm sure this will get edited out. So, Sui Chi, what we wanted to really start with was the last 12 months have been unusual for everyone, to say the least. And we would really like to find out how you found the whole experience and any lessons learned that you want to share.
In a very strange way, I felt very engaged in the last 12 months. The last time I traveled was on, I returned from UK just before Chinese New Year on January the 23rd. I have not traveled ever since, yeah? But I went into Zoom, understanding COVID-19, blogging in East Asia, and then connected with actuaries in the UK and Stuart McDonald, setting up the actuaries response group, and learning how to use Zoom, right? Just like I was telling you. And I conducted seminars across the region for about 800 to 1,000 people in different sessions. And that sort of typifies the experience. And because I was not traveling, I think I was able to manage my diet better and my sleep better. So I've lost weight. I learned new things in yoga and swimming. So it has been, from that aspect, I'm very fortunate. Partly because Singapore is not as badly hit as some other countries. And also, I'm fortunate to have a family and to have a house here where I got space, yeah. So at certain times we couldn't go out, yeah, and there was a lockdown, but that was not for very long. But now we are under limited lockdown. So the whole experience was not as negative, but I think I'm fortunate. There must be many of our members and staff, you know, in the UK and elsewhere who have experienced the actual COVID-19 themselves. Two of our council members, at least two I know of, are hit, and it was not a pleasant experience. And some of my friends who have the injections, vaccines, some significant reaction for some of them, but not all of them. But in my case, on a personal level and a family level, it was certainly not as negative as for some. Yeah. And strangely for IFOA, we did more things in a different way in terms of doing online seminars, making decisions more quickly, and we are having effective meetings, yeah, at council level and board levels quickly. And I'm meeting more people across the region and with the UK, because in the past, if I go to UK, it's only about 7 to 10 days, and I would try to pack everything in and come back and rest and then do everything else by email. But now I'm having, on an average day, with IFOA Matters, about 3 to 4 hours at least of meetings to keep it before my dinner time. And sometimes I got an extra 1 or 2 hours after dinner. So I'm quite engaged. Yeah.
I was just going to ask you, you know, I think because of, and I don't know if we're going to get to this later, but because of previous experiences, I guess, in East Asia with SARS and other kind of threats, I guess, like that, do you feel that in Western Europe and in the West, we were severely underprepared for that psychologically, for something like this to happen? And were you, for example, in Malaysia, Singapore, in China, were you more psychologically ready for something like this to happen?
Okay, I think Singapore and Hong Kong and Taiwan were better prepared, both psychologically and also in terms of systems and governance. Yeah, I'm not so sure I would include Malaysia. Okay, and there are many hypotheses about that or observations about that. Yeah, clearly, I think Europe and UK, there are lessons to be learned. There are lessons to be learned. And it's not exactly a black swan. It's something which has been predicted to happen. And that is in the nature of psychology and biases, right? Even if you know that something is bad or can happen, it doesn't mean that you prepare for it, right? That's why some of us continue to smoke and continue to drink and not exercise, right? Yeah, so there you are. But then there are certain other observations about culture, the emphasis on freedom as in Sweden and elsewhere. And then the other places where it's an emphasis on collective interest and public good, and which precedes. And I wouldn't argue A is better than B and B is better than A, but we must be conscious of the consequences of just being bipolar. Eh? So we need to make sure that we get the best blends. Yeah, and that pervades to more than just pandemics. Yeah, in the way how we organize self-interest versus group interest. I think there's a very rich field there. And I think it applies to economic arrangements, financial regulations, and so forth.
And in your presidential address, you talk about digital revolution and transformational change. Do you think a silver lining of the last 12 months would be kind of these digital revolutions have been expedited?
Without doubt, in different ways. Because a lot of our assumptions about sustainability were challenged in the last 12 months. So, but we start with digital first. The strategy which I was working with my colleagues in the council was more about skill sets and how we need to widen our skill sets. And the fundamental argument starting in 2017, that is about 4 years ago, was about our usual skills, our normal traditional skills, needs to be refreshed to include data science, machine learning, and AI, because that is a fundamental extension of statistics in a world of big data. And being successful risk modelers and people who do pricing, you need to have that as a defense of your current domain. But the incorporation of that into our skill sets also enable us to go into other domains where there is an abundance of data. So don't restrict yourself to GI, life and pension, but you can go into platform companies, health ecosystems, gaming companies, all kinds of, or even banks and all that, as long as there's data and where you've got to deal with risk and modeling. So that was the argument. But so that requires not just skill sets, because it's not just about skills. It's about how you become more innovative. By that, I mean more curious, using of design thinking, adaptable. And it's not just being about accurate and cautious. Yeah. So it's a very different box of skill sets. The first box of skill sets, I always call them to be quintessential skill sets, which is very necessary for traditional work, especially in long-term life and pensions and so forth, right? But this one is going to the more digital space, what I call the innovative skill set. But the last 12 months also destabilizes our belief about the security and the sustainability of our systems, right? Suddenly, no one has seen that the whole world is under lockdown, right? No one has foreseen it. You know, we are supposed to be risk managers, right? No one has foreseen it. If someone tells you that I'm not going to I will never touch UK soil through the entire term of my presidency in December 2019. I say, why? No one will be able to tell me why, right? But I won't be touch, you'll be the first UK IFA president who has never touched UK soil. I think it's going to be showing up that way. It's totally unpredictable, right? But actually, it can be imagined as a scenario, but it's certainly not predicted. So and then, of course, the benefits of the lockdown on climate change. Yeah? So there are a lot of systemic risks, but actually, it's due with systematic risk which you can capture in probability distribution theories and stochastic processes. We are very good at that. But this is a systemic risk, yeah, because the system itself is the issue. And that one, we need systems thinking and a systemic mindset. So two words come to mind, which is about courage and imagination, and lastly, judgment. Because in dealing with uncertainty of this nature, you need a totally different mindset, yeah? Because it's not about accuracy and cautiousness and reticence, right? So when I'm pricing something within a stable system, when I'm doing a financial report, I want to be accurate and cautious and consistent in my assumptions, obviously. But if this system is not working, I'm exploring what other systems should replace it. Accuracy doesn't help, right? Because you are really looking outwards. You look at ideas, and there's imagination and courage, right? So the world has become more global and more networked, and small little things in one place like Wuhan could lock down the world, right? Because you're also connected. So this is a world where risk can be very non-linear, non-stationary, and the effects could be very disproportionate. Yeah? It's not a uniform effect over time. So there's the world we live in now, and I think that ignites our sensitivity towards things like climate risk, biodiversity loss, and we are taking things more seriously. And today we are submitting, IFOA is submitting a submission to Her Majesty government on the regulatory framework for financial institutions because of Brexit, right? And we're doing an overlay to say that it's not really just about getting the regulation right, but the fundamental assumptions on which our regulation rests on, which is the pursuit of growth, expressed as the growth of share price as a proxy for value, may have to be looked at. Not because I say so, but because people like Mervyn King and to that financial value does not necessarily equal to human or societal value. Man. So we've got some fundamental questions.
Thank you.
So I was just going to say...
That was a phenomenal answer.
I was just going to say that, obviously, the three of us, so Adarise V and I, are general insurance actuaries, but you're the president of the whole institute. You talked about imagination and courage and innovation and, you know, mindset. Do you see a difference between life actuaries and pensions actuaries or investment actuaries? Are all of our behaviours similar, or are they quite different? What have you noticed in your experience?
Okay, but I think there are differences because of difference in training and we are self-selection. But let us not be too, stereotype, yeah? Because there could be quite a few cautious GI actuaries, and there could be creative and imaginative. But I suspect there are differences because of the nature of their training and the industry they work in. If I'm a life actuary, I'm especially of the traditional type, I'm concerned about long-term contract and matching and financial reporting, longevity and mortality and interest rates. A GI actuary is less concerned about that. It's about pricing for the next year, and it's more short-term. And the use of digital data is probably more pervasive, impact on devices and drones and on various tools you use, you know, seems to be more in the GI area, So sometimes I feel that there might be greater dynamism there. But that is not to say that there are no dynamisms in the life industry or pension. I think it's a question of cycles. But I think the word is not either or. I think the word is about diversity of mindsets, right? So I use the word widening of skill sets. Yeah? Widening and deepening, right? Because in the new world, you cannot just be a generalist either. I think it's quite good to have some strong specialist skills. Two or three things. But the diversity of mindsets, I think I often quote Reddington because I feel that he is really an icon in the last 100 years. And the word he cleverly used is that we don't have any vices, but we could have, what's the name he used? That we could have a virtue, an exaggerated virtue. Yeah? A virtue, he got a word for it, which is exaggerated virtue. And too strong a virtue can become our weakness. And he said that we should create room for imagination and impulse. But when he say impulse, he doesn't mean impulsiveness. He meant your instinct, yeah, or your imagination, yeah, or gut.
Yeah, and I think that's what I was getting at.
I think that's really important.
But one is not better than the other, but more that what can we learn from each other? Because as you say, life and pensions actuaries may, for example, be better at identifying and understanding systemic risks. And general insurance actuaries might be, you know, more dynamic or more embracing of technology and change. So, you know, what can we learn from each other within our own kind of umbrella of actuaries rather than thinking about what's better or worse? So, yeah. Sorry, Scott, I interrupted.
Yep.
Yes, sorry. It's great set of questions, and sort of your answer was so broad, Suiche. I wanted to ask that point in terms of making our actuaries more innovative, and I think this is across as a GI actuary as well, even within the GI field. How do we change our exam system or our training system to make our actuaries more agile, more practical, and to allow that kind of innovative thinking to come through and qualify as actuaries?
We have a program called Lifelong Learning Change Program, and there's a code word for it called Moonshot. Moonshot, yeah. And it has a number of tenets. One is that learning is actually a personal responsibility, so you really got to take ownership of learning, and you've got to encourage that. Yeah. Secondly, we are going to introduce more optionality and modularization so you can choose things which are relevant to you. And learning is not going to be based on, actually, increasingly, it's not just about qualification, but maintaining a sense of currency, you know, learning throughout life. Yeah, throughout life. So the whole positioning, but of course, you will still have exams, right? Because you got to be realistic about this. Yeah. But also, more importantly, we are going to also position the profession not just as something which is based on legacy or the past, but more on the future. So that's a very big piece of work. So in terms of what you could expect, I think we're going to have a certificate in climate science quite shortly. We're going to have a fellowship in banking. And the guys are beginning to introduce, to convert our associateship and fellowship into more modular pieces. So that is a 12 to 18 months type work. And they're busy working on it, but that has been signed off by the council. So that is the how-to at a technical level. But I think but you also got to position the profession, right? How you describe ourselves and what we believe about ourselves, and to have role models, that should be increasingly in our communication. And also, what kind of people are you attracting? So we normally attract people who are good in mathematics, who are high score, who want to have a financially rewarding career. And their choices, currency, MBA, maths, stats, physics, engineering. I think we are all sort of there. Yeah? I mean, we're schoolboys, but we heard about. But the group who wanted to be successful in a corporate sense would tend to do actuarial science. Those who went to accountancy and MBA tend to be less mathematical. Yeah. So we got this core. But in this group, we also can also get more diversity of mindsets. It doesn't mean that you are mathematical, you can't be curious. Yeah. There are many, and some of the skills can be learned. Say, for instance, innovation. Innovation can be learned through design thinking, six thinking heads, and the way you process information, and a lot of it is sort of self-awareness, right? And the growth mindset, which is part of the vocabulary of BSND, basically suggests that you don't believe that things are fixed for you. Yeah. So there are many things we could do. So this is actually a process which will take 2 to 5 years, 2 to 5 years. And the signs of change are there, but we must continue to be coherent in our desire to do so. That's my view.
Yeah, I think you've made a few good points, and sort of going back to sort of what you said, I think the last 12 months, the pause button that we all had to hit in the last 12 months has allowed us, especially around sustainability and regulations, to kind of start afresh with innovation, with new ideas, with objectives aligned to the science-based targets, with, I think, learnings, as Sameer said, from life, pensions, investments, GI. And I think that has been, again, another silver lining. I'm not saying this is kind of going to balance out all the things that have happened in the last 12 months, but this is fantastic. And I think, again, in the sort of the response you mentioned to the Treasury, I think there are quite a few innovative ideas to this sort of make things efficient and better. So you are quite right there. But I think one of probably Zvi's question was the newer members of the profession, one of the sort of difficulties they may have faced is face-to-face learnings from practitioners. That you can learn a lot by kind of talking to people, sitting next to people at workplaces, and that has kind of been missing. And I think a lot of people have had to work hard to keep themselves motivated through these difficult times.
I couldn't agree more. In UK, especially now in the winter, I assume it's quite dark. Yeah, and in many parts of the world, right? So there, I think the antidote is that I think we have no choice, right? But to accept the condition we are in, because you can't resist it, and adjust, right? And then respond to it using your own internal resources. That is for the person involved, right? To figure out, because the situation is obviously not something we desire. So the first part of unpleasantness is a recognition that you are in that situation, but not to be stuck in it. And then to adjust, to psychologically adjust, and then respond. And for those of us who are in a more fortunate situation and people might need help and you are in a good opportunity to help, then you should not miss the opportunity to help in engagement. I think engagement is very important. So to the extent that you could connect or help a colleague, that would be fantastic. Yeah, this is the first time we have felt uncertainty in the world, a global felt uncertainty. We have a lot of crises, whether it is Berlin Wall or Tiananmen riots in Hong Kong, but they're all localized. You see? The last big one, which is sort of global, it's probably the Second World War, the First World War, right? But it's before our lifetime. So our lifetime, it is a major one. And it is a salutary lesson. It's a salutary lesson that things which you think take for granted. And the breakdown in relations between East and West is also a source of concern. Yeah? It's a source of, because the world has become suddenly more complicated.
And I think in your presidential address, if I remember correctly, you mentioned that we have to be relevant, influential, and impactful. And I think you felt that some of the feedback that you received was that the IFO was bureaucratic and slow in some respect. But and you were keen to change that. And I mean, even for this sort of podcast interview, I just had to drop you an email and things were arranged in like 4 weeks. So I don't think things are slow at all. And both Zvi and I, we met you when you were the president-elect and you had your vision. And listening to you in the sort of presidential address, we could see that your vision has not changed. But would you say that COVID-related sort of uncertainties have impacted it in any way, or has it kind of slowed it down?
No, yeah, it's not slowed down yet. You know, I think it has influenced it positively, because the case was changed, has increased, and the organization has responded to it in terms of execution as well as in terms of governance changes. Yeah, in terms of governance. So actually, the COVID-19 from that narrow point. Was a plus. So yeah, it's not. So the move to online exams, right? If there was no COVID-19, you would not even go there in 3 years, even if we decided. But we went there in less than 3 months. Can you imagine it? If you want to go online exams, we will be arguing about security and plagiarization and trial runs. We never launch in 3 years. I'm quite sure about that. But when our backs are to the wall, we did it in 2 months.
Well, I remember a couple of years ago.
And we are the only international organization who has done it. The only.
Yeah.
So that's quite remarkable, right? So I told the executive team, you have the right to embrace that with pride. And we need more of that in terms of small things, in terms of mindset, in the way of handling complaints, in the way of creating value for members, because we are a member-centric organization. Even in governance.
That's the rule.
Governance, but my picture is a dynamic IFOA response to its membership, relevant and influential in our workplace, and also quite impressive professional body with lots of thought leaders. Right? But that obviously is a continuing journey. Like, you can't just, it's not one person's or one team or even one council's job. But I'm pleased with how things are progressing.
So I think that's a really important part of the institution to offer value to members, which you just mentioned there. And I mean, we look back at Adhiraj, myself, and we look around and others in their pricing teams, in the consultancies, and we see data scientists. My pricing team is of approximately 20 members. There's only two qualified actuaries within that pricing team. We've got data scientists, we've got a lot of people who dropped out of the exam process, some who never started. What would make a young person coming into this field today want to become an actuary? And what? How do we make sure that the profession continues to offer value to someone who's got data science skills, mathematics skills, engineering skills? Why should they? Why should they want to become an actuary in today's day and age?
Now, there are two ways to handle this question. One is to, you are a student. I'm going to give you a proposition of why you should be. The other one is, you as a fellow member of IFOA to make sure that the proposition is true. Yeah. So there are two ways to look at it. But let's do it the first way. I would say that, of course, you can be a data scientist and it's a great profession. You can be an accountant, it's a great profession. But if you come to the IFOA, it's a professional body with two pillars, which is data science is a skill. Yeah. But we are a profession and we've got two pillars. One pillar is ethics. Yeah. Code of conduct. That gives us a reputation. The second pillar is the one on business judgment. A data scientist, have you met a pure data scientist? They would not talk in the language you can talk. Yeah, we had rubbish ourselves, which we often do. But actually, they can't talk the way we talk. So I've been to a seminar, and you talk to data scientists, you mean there's fraud in insurance? It's a big revelation, right? But they wouldn't, because they learn data science. A variable is a variable. It's a variable. They don't look at a control cycle. They don't have a business mindset. So with these two pillars, we can spin a lot of stories, or we offer value. And let's be fair about this. Yeah, the life and pension actuaries have created a reputation of us being serious people. Like, we are not fly by night. Right? I mean, we are all serious, and we are analytical and probably quite clever. So there's this aura, right? So that's why you join us. And besides, the profession is transforming to be better than data science. Yeah. So that's what I would tell the students, which I will do on Monday. I'm speaking to about 200 students in Southeast Asia, why they should join us. Okay, on the flip side of the coin, Evie, as a fellow, and Samuel, let's make sure it's true. Continue to make sure it's true. And I was gonna ask, why are you in this podcast? Why are you not leaving the profession? Because you love the community, despite you might have a slight love-hate relationship. But we do love the community, and we have. But the problem we have, it's a reflection of ourselves, yeah, because we are the profession. So if you want change, we still haven't got a GI president yet, right? You want change, you should be engaged and come in because it's your profession. So you should argue your case out, right? Argue your case out. So I encourage you.
I was going to say diversity of thought is kind of really important, but it's about attracting that diversity of thought as well. So one thing I noticed recently was, I think it was in the Sun newspaper, or there was some UK tabloid newspaper that featured the COVID-19 action group, you know, from the Institute of Actuaries. And that's quite a rare publicised form of us expressing ourselves. How important do you think it is that we are more out there for the general public to see and hear from? Because that might attract that diversity of thought into our profession.
I blog about this quite a bit. So that article on the Sun was about John Roberts' prediction about case counts of hospitalization because of vaccination. Actually, I suspect the mathematics might not be that complicated, because it's a lag effect of an exponential growth. It's a reverse, right? It does go down very quickly. But anyway, so he did. But it's the way he was presented and the context he was presented, right? So it appeared not just in the Sun, but Financial Times, Daily Telegraph at least twice, The Times, Daily Mail, BBC, Sky News, all in 10, 15 days, all the major papers. The profession has never had such wide reporting in the last 50 years, probably the last 100 years, because who would be? But this was an issue which concerns the average person in UK, right? And we had the skills, but this time, we had the capability to articulate it. And in a recent posting, I did say that actuaries by definitions are good in logos, which is about analysis and logic. But we are not very good in establishing the ethos. Ethos is about authority or trustworthiness to speak. And the other third one is about pathos, which is about engaging people in a way which is emotional or which is contextual or which is easily understood. It doesn't matter how good or right your paper is if no one reads it. For someone to read it, they must find you authoritative and trustworthy to read it. If say, Albert Einstein has something to say about religion, you want to hear him because it's Albert Einstein. Somebody else, because it's Albert. And then, firstly, because of his trustworthiness. And the other one is the way he says it, right? The way he says it. It's not really about the content, right? So that is really important. We care too much. Okay, we care a lot about content, and that is important. But we must have the ability to articulate it with clarity and with succinctness, right? So Stuart McDonald, whom I have not met in person, but I've sort of dealt with him many times in Zoom meetings, who have we met, you and Nicola are now running the ARG, personifies that. Because if you hear what he says, in more and less, he said in a very calm tone, respectful, but with confidence, you see, and with authority. And I've seen him behind the scenes with senior members of the SAGE, the Scientific Advisory Government Panel, right? Senior, I won't name them. He turned them around by his simple logic. I might say so, I was talking to a president of a leading professional body, which is actuarial, I won't name which country, this morning. And he says that they are producing all these publications and they're getting longer and longer, but nobody reads them or the press was not interested. I was able to tell him, but he knew about ARG. I was able to tell him that was not the case for us. But because no one knows whether ARG is a formal group or an informal group, but he knew about it anyway. So I'm very proud about ARG. And not just me, right? Samir, you'll get a link. We just had a Renaissance group. It's a group of senior actuaries, 12 actuaries, Ashok Sami, Seamus, and all that. They're more senior actuaries who sort of felt IWA has lost its way, and they were trying. I spoke to them over the last 18 months. So I felt to get them together. The whole idea was for me to engage them to a dinner and all that, but of course it's not going to happen. So we had this conversation. And they were also of the same view, how proud they were. Of ARG, you see. So we got to, and they encouraged us to be slightly bolder, but not crazy bolder. I don't think I think we always with judgment, right? So we can be slightly, and I think that we got to be more embracing of new ways of communication. So I hope this will continue. This is just an inflection point, right, for us to go forward.
Thank you. I think it's always refreshing and good to hear your thoughts, and we could just chat for hours. But conscious of time, we kind of wanted to ask you one question. Like, if we look at your career, studied economics, you studied organizational psychology, you worked for a psychometric consulting firm, you were the CEO of a financial services entity of a company, then you became the group CEO of a company that kind of looked at retail, food and beverage, financial services, education and training services. It's a checkered and illustrious career. Like, can you tell our listeners like two or three sort of key turning points in your career?
I will do that, but because of the way you asked the question, I've always been curious. Yeah, curious. So I think Steve Jobs' thing about stay foolish, stay hungry, be curious. Yeah, I was curious, and I have always curious through books, now through internet, to audible.com, and I always try to join the dots. It's not about this conversation, it's about that conversation. And I try to look at structured holes. Structured holes is a term used in networks about big ties. These are places which there are gaps, and you don't normally, no point talking to another GI actuary. You talk to your best GI actuary's friend who's interested in philosophy. So you got a relationship. So those will be the areas where you can find insights. Yeah. So I'm always that by I didn't plan to be, but I had been. Yeah, so that was quite a big point. But if you're talking about, but going to Columbia was good because I was interested in psychology. So the Columbia gave me what I call the refreshing of the intellectual curiosity. And as a result, I could do the work. See, my first 20 years was with Prudential, which is very commercial and was very senior, blah, blah, blah. But I probably felt a bit stagnant or middle-age crisis. Then I went to Columbia. When I came back, I went to a psychological consultancy firm for 4 years, SHL, which is a listed company in the UK at that time. But after that, I was in the world of cooperatives, right? And world cooperatives is very different from a commercial company where I learned about not maximization of profits, but maximization of value for the customers. But they have their own cultural issues. And that is a concept of cooperatives and mutuality, which is slowly coming back to fashion. Yeah, but there's a larger conversation about how society should be run or how companies should be run. So that's why I'm curious. And I got another group of fellow actuaries called Actuaries for Transformational Change, you know, and we have been meeting for 34 or 35 times now since COVID. Yeah, that's the most, not every week, but once at least 1 to 2 weeks. Yeah? And we, most of us come from economics background or systemic background or risk background or sustainability backgrounds. And it was fun to test your ideas and to learn, right? Test your ideas. And I would encourage actuaries to do that because most of us, compared to the general population, do appreciate cognitive interest. So we could form groups of discussion, write a paper, present something, something to encourage members to do. And that was how the profession grew, you know? That's how the profession grew, to people meeting, talking, and solving problems. And all the problems had to do with uncertainty, because death was an uncertainty, morbidity was an uncertainty, then pricing for capital redemption and God knows what, pensions and all that. Trying to make sense of uncertainty and risk. Well, risk is part of uncertainty, right?
You had to contribute once upon a time to become part of the profession. It wasn't sort of when it started, you had to be a contributor to become part of the society, that you had created something new and you'd done something more to change the profession. That's what it would have been in the 16 and 17, probably in the 1800s as well, until we moved to the exam process. How should people make sure that they're always contributing back, I guess?
Yes. Okay, but I think the exam process will be necessary, like given our scale, right? Given our scale. I think at that time, it might be more informal. But that's my desire to create a more learned society feel, right? So you want to interconnect with people with other disciplines, but within ourselves, we could encourage not just learning, but creating new things, right? So in the presidential update, I did highlight some of the things which our members are doing, but we need to encourage that and profile that, right? Because that is positive and there are GI people, there are people doing AI work, you know, pricing. And I suspect there are quite a few in the London market which are doing interesting stuff, which are commercially sensitive. So that wouldn't surprise me. Aditya, I'm going to ask you, is it meant to be 45 minutes or 1 hour? Because I got somebody sort of in my waiting room. I think that person could be early. Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, I was planning to wrap it up.
Okay.
Was there any other questions anyone wanted to ask, or otherwise I'll wrap it up.
I was just going to ask what you're going to miss most about London or not having been to London.
Well, I miss engaging some of the university students, and also one of the present job is to visit the societies in Birmingham, Liverpool, and Bournemouth and all that. So and Edinburgh, which I love, Glasgow. I miss those, and I miss London itself. I love London, and I live in London for 10, 12 years, and Samuel knows it. I met Samuel for lunch somewhere in the Strand, I think. I love what he has to offer, and the pubs and the restaurants and the theatres. So I miss that. But I shall come back. When I come back, I'll have even more time because I won't be president then.
Thank you, Suchi. It seems you've had a very busy 12 months, and it's always good to listen to your refreshing honesty. And I'm sure whatever we discuss, it is going to motivate me to do a few things. At the very least, lose some weight. Great speaking to you. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Take good care, Samuel, Avi, Ibi, and Adraj. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Bye. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Later this evening. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.